This is Audible.
What a Wonderful World. One Man's Attempt to Explain the Big Stuff by Marcus Chown. Read by Clive Mantle. Forward. This book came about because I have an exceptional editor, Neil Belton. In fact, I am his stalker. I have pursued him all the way from Jonathan Cape to Faber. Neil has many talents. But one of those talents is that he knows what his authors are good at and what they should be writing better than they do. My skill is that I can take complex physics and explain it to someone on a number 25 bus, or perhaps I should say someone unfortunate enough to be sitting next to me on a number 25 bus. But in addition to physics, I am also interested in other things. I read a lot of fiction. I am interested in history. I like running. In fact, in 2012, I did the London Marathon, something I rarely fail to mention in the first 3 minutes of meeting someone. Neil's big idea was that I combine these two things, that I use my skill at explaining complex physics in layperson's terms to explain everything in layperson's terms. I was daunted. How could I possibly write about everything? Where would I even start? I began thinking about how to organize such a wide range of material logically. But I tore up outline after outline. What changed everything, however, was writing Solar System for iPad. I had only 9 weeks to write 120 stories about planets, moons, asteroids, and comets, so I had no option but simply to dive in and learn to swim on the job. It must have worked, because the app won several awards. So that is what I did. I overcame my apprehension and just dived in. It was a struggle. Usually, when I need to know something about physics, I identify a physicist, it could be a Nobel Prize winner, and simply phone them. There is a 95% chance they will be able to answer my stupid questions immediately, and if they cannot, they will at least make an attempt at answering them. But with subjects I know nothing about, such as money, sex, and the human brain, it was difficult even to identify someone who might be able to answer my incredibly basic questions. And when I did and phoned them, they were often not able to explain things at the toddler level I needed. Worse, it was sometimes as if we were speaking different languages. Often I had to go to 2, 3, or 4 people before I could find someone who could answer all my questions. And, on occasion, I could not find anyone who was able to do that. Instead, I was forced to piece together an explanation from things people I had gone to had said and from things I had read. But Neil was right. This was the book I should have been writing. It was one that stretched me beyond my comfort zone and that, ultimately, proved to be an exhilarating and a joyful experience. I loved learning about all kinds of things I know nothing about, and I began to appreciate what a wonderful world we live in, one far more incredible than anything we could possibly have invented. Along the way, I learnt many surprising things, such as, to understand a single collateralized debt obligation squared, one of the toxic investments that sunk the world economy in 2008, would require reading 1 billion pages of documentation. Slime molds have 13 sexes, and you think you have problems finding and keeping a partner. You could fit the whole human race in the volume of a sugar cube. You are one-third mushroom. That is, you share one-third of your DNA with fungi. You age more slowly on the ground floor of a building than on the top floor. The crucial advantage that humans had over Neanderthals was sewing. IBM once predicted that the global market for computers was 5. Today your body will build about 300 billion cells, more than there are stars in our galaxy. No wonder I get knackered doing nothing. Believe it or not, the universe may be a giant hologram. You may be a hologram. If everything in our information-overloaded society has passed you by in a high-speed blur, my book just might bring you quickly and painlessly up to speed on how the world of the 21st century works. It is, after all, one man's attempt to understand everything. No, I cannot really claim that. It's one man's attempt to understand everything. Volume 1. Marcus Chown, London, March 2013. Part 1. How We Work. Chapter 1. I Am a Galaxy. Cells. A good case can be made for our non-existence as entities. Lewis Thomas. There's someone in my head, and it's not me. Pink Floyd. I think I am me, but I am not. I am a galaxy. In fact, I am 1,000 galaxies. There are more cells in my body than there are stars in 1,000 Milky Ways. And of all those myriad cells, not a single one knows who I am or cares. I am not even writing this. The thought was actually a bunch of brain cells, neurons, sending electrical signals down my spinal cord to another bunch of cells in the muscles of my hand. Everything I do is the result of the coordinated action of untold trillions upon trillions of cells. I like to think my cells work in my interest, that each breath they draw from me, but perhaps it is they who walk through a park in the early morning, sensing my senses, listening to my music, thinking my thoughts, wrote American biologist Lewis Thomas. The first step on the road to discovering that each and every one of us is a super colony of cells was the discovery of the cell itself. Credit for this goes to Dutch linen merchant Antony van Leeuwenhoek, aided by a tiny magnifying glass he had adapted from one used to check the fibre density of fabrics. He became the first person in history to see a living cell. In a letter published in April 1673 in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society of London, van Leeuwenhoek wrote, "I have observed taking some blood out of my hand that it consists of small round globules." The term cell had actually been coined 2 decades earlier by the English scientist Robert Hooke. In 1655, he had examined plant tissue and noticed dead compartments stacked together. However, neither he nor van Leeuwenhoek realized that the cells are the Lego bricks of life. But that is what they are. A cell is the biological atom. There is no life, as far as we know, except cellular life. Prokaryotes, a protected micro-universe. The first evidence of cells comes from fossils about 3.5 billion years old. But there is more tentative evidence from about 3.8 billion years ago in the shape of telltale chemical imbalances in rocks that are characteristic of living things. The first cells, known as prokaryotes, were essentially just tiny transparent bags of gloop, less than 1/1000th of a millimetre across. The bag, by concentrating stuff inside, speeded up key chemical reactions such as those that generate energy. It also protected proteins and other fragile products of those reactions from toxic substances such as acids and salt in the environment. The bag of gloop was an island haven in an ocean of disorder and chaos, a protected micro-universe where order and complexity might safely grow. The complexity of such cells was in large part due to the proteins, megamolecules assembled from amino acid building blocks and made of millions of atoms. Depending on their shape and chemical properties, these Swiss Army knife molecules can carry out a myriad tasks, from speeding up chemical reactions, to acting as cellular scaffolding, to flexing like coiled springs to power the movement of cells. Even a simple bacterium possesses about 4,000 different proteins, though some proteins, such as those needed for reproduction, are assembled or expressed only intermittently. The structure of these proteins is encoded by deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA, a double helical molecule floating freely as a loop in the chemical soup, or cytoplasm, inside a cell. Cellular structure is beautifully intricate. First, there is the bag, or membrane. This is made of fatty acids, molecules that are characterized by having a water-loving end and a water-hating end. When such lipids come together in large numbers, typically a billion, they spontaneously self-assemble into two layers, with their water-hating ends on the interior and their water-loving ends on the outside. The lipid layers that enclose a cell are not a passive barrier, far from it. This double skin regulates the molecules coming in and going out of the cell. Imagine the cell as an ancient city surrounded by a wall. In the same way that small creatures such as mice can pass easily back and forth through the city wall, small molecules can pass unhindered in and out of the cell membrane. And just as bigger creatures such as people are admitted only through gates in the city wall, the passage of big molecules is regulated by gates in the cell membrane. For instance, there are proteins shaped like hollow tubes spanning the width of the membrane, through which bigger molecules can tunnel into and tunnel out of the cell. And there are transporter proteins whose job is to shuttle bigger molecules physically from one side of the membrane to the other. The molecules that come into the cell are those needed for energy, and to make proteins, and to provide information about the outside world. For instance, an abundance in the surrounding environment of molecules necessary for building new cells might trigger a cell to reproduce. On the other hand, a shortage of water molecules coming across the membrane might warn a cell that it is in danger of drying out. This might trigger a cascade of chemical reactions inside the cell, ultimately causing a stretch of DNA to be copied repeatedly into molecules called ribonucleic acid, or RNA. These find their way to ribosomes, nanomachines that use the RNA templates to make proteins that might be components of a mucus that will protect the cell from dehydration. Too big to pass through the cell membrane, the proteins flooding out through the cytoplasm in their millions are packaged into membrane sacs, or vesicles, which fuse with the cell membrane. The membrane can then open up without rupturing and losing its structural integrity and cast them into the outside world. But cells, in addition to responding to molecules in their environment, also respond to molecules from other cells. Even the simplest and most ancient prokaryotes cooperated with each other, which is revealed by fossils of large microbial communities known as stromatolites. Living stromatolites can still be found today, for instance, in shallow tropical waters off the western coast of Australia, but the oldest of these fossil communities is about 3.5 billion years old. At the same time that a cell makes proteins to protect itself from environmental changes, it might produce proteins that warn others of its kind to do the same. Such chemical signaling is crucial to the survival of simple prokaryotes, which often live in huge colonies known as biofilms, quite possibly the first organized structures to appear on Earth. The cells on the inside of such a biofilm might secrete a sugary protein that sticks their membranes to the membrane of other cells, whereas those on the outside of the film might produce proteins that help protect them from the environmental toxins. Some cells will even kill themselves in order to yield up precious nitrogen for the good of their companions. This kind of cooperation, with cells within a group differentiating to carry out different tasks, is reminiscent of the cells in our bodies. It hints at how such cellular super-cooperation might have got started billions of years ago. There are limits on the size and complexity of prokaryotes. For one thing, the proteins assembled or expressed by their DNA can travel only by drifting slowly or diffusing across a cell. Beyond a certain size, a prokaryote is therefore suicidally slow in reacting to environmental dangers. This problem has been solved by rare prokaryotes, such as Thiomargaryta namibiensis, discovered only in 1997. The giant sulphur bacterium, which is about 0.75 millimetres across and easily visible to the naked eye, possesses not one loop of DNA, but thousands, spread evenly throughout its cytoplasm. This means that proteins expressed by local strands of DNA, even if they diffuse slowly, can still get to all parts of the cell rapidly. But there is another serious problem that keeps prokaryotes small. The bigger one of them grows, the more energy it needs. If it were to use the strategy of T. namibiensis, however, an increasing proportion of that energy would be needed for manipulating large quantities of DNA, since this would be at the expense of any other cellular processes. The road to increased complexity is well and truly blocked. But there is another way to grow big. Take up cannibalism. Eukaryotes. Cities in bags. About 1.8 billion years ago, a prokaryote swallowed another prokaryote. Prokaryotes actually include bacteria and more exotic archaea bacteria, microorganisms that survive in extreme environments, such as boiling sulfur springs, and so were probably among the first life forms on Earth. What actually happened 1.8 billion years ago was that an archaeobacterium swallowed a bacterium. Such an event must have occurred innumerable times before, but in all cases the bacterium was either devoured or spat out. This time, for some unknown reason, the bacterium survived. More than that, it thrived. There was some mutual benefit for the swallower and swallowee. The latter found a protective environment, safe from the hostile outside world, and the former a new power source. The evidence that something like this did indeed happen was gathered by the American biologist Lynn Margulis, the first wife of TV astronomer Carl Sagan. And the evidence is still around us today. The energy-generating mitochondria inside the eukaryotic cells of all animals are not only the same size as free-living bacteria, but they look like them too. Even more striking, they have their own DNA, which is separate and distinct from the DNA of the whole cell and fashioned into a loop exactly as in prokaryotes. In fact, eukaryotes may have hundreds or even thousands of such mitochondria. These are self-contained power stations, furiously reacting hydrogen from food with oxygen to make life's mobile power packs, adenosine triphosphate, or ATP. "My mitochondria comprise a very large proportion of me," wrote American biologist Lewis Thomas. "I suppose there is almost as much of them in sheer dry weight as there is of the rest of me. Looked at this way, I could be taken for a very large, motile colony of respiring bacteria." With a cell's mitochondria working semi-autonomously in this way, it is no longer necessary for it to devote so much of its DNA to the task of generating energy. The DNA is free to encode other things, other protein nanomachinery. Consequently, when cells gained mitochondria 1.8 billion years ago, they were suddenly free to grow a whole lot bigger and more complex. A large eukaryote compared with a typical prokaryote is like a cat beside a flea. Such a mega cell might contain hundreds, even thousands, of membrane-enshrouded bags. These organelles divvy up the chores of the cell, functioning as the equivalent of factories, post office sorting offices, and other specialist buildings in a modern-day city. Lysosomes, for instance, are the garbage disposal units of the cell. They break down molecules, such as proteins, into their building blocks so they can be used again. The reason the lettuce in your burger wilts is that heat from the beef breaks down the lysosome membranes of the lettuce cells. This unleashes enzymes which devour the lettuce. Other organelles include the rough endoplasmic reticulum, which acts like a cellular DHL office. Dotted with ribosomes, it translates RNA arriving from the nucleus into proteins destined for foreign parts beyond the cell. Yet another organelle is the Golgi apparatus, which acts like a packaging center. It can modify proteins, wrapping them, for instance, in a sugar coating that absorbs water. Such proteins can be used to make the surfaces of blood cells slimy so they can move about more easily. In fact, a eukaryotic cell is less like a single organism than a colony of organisms, each of which long ago lost its ability to survive alone. For the first half of geological time, our ancestors were bacteria, says Richard Dawkins. Most creatures still are bacteria, and each one of our trillions of cells is a colony of bacteria. And all of this has come about by chance. The mitochondrion that first entered another cell was not thinking about the future benefits of cooperation and integration, says Stephen Jay Gould. It was merely trying to make its own living in a tough Darwinian world. The organelles are subservient to the cell's nucleus, which contains its DNA and orchestrates pretty much all cellular activity. The English botanist Robert Brown recognized the nucleus as a common feature of complex cells in 1833. Enclosed in a double membrane, the nucleus is reminiscent of a walled castle inside the walled city of the cell. The membrane controls the passage of molecules into the nucleus and the passage of proteins expressed by the DNA out of the nucleus. The presence of a nucleus is one of the defining features of a eukaryote, along with the presence of a plethora of organelles. A prokaryote has neither a nucleus nor organelles. In fact, the very word prokaryote means before kernel or nucleus, while eukaryote means true nucleus. Very probably, a nucleus is a necessity in a cell as complex as a eukaryote because of the need to protect the precious DNA from the frenzied activity going on in every corner. In addition to having a nucleus and a large number of organelles, a eukaryote contrasts with a prokaryote in having a cytoskeleton. Proteins such as tubulin form long scaffolding poles that crisscross the cell. Such microtubules stiffen the soft bag of the cell, giving it a shape. They also anchor organelles to the membrane. This ensures that they are arranged in a similar way in all eukaryotes, much as internal organs are arranged in a similar way in all humans. But in addition to providing internal scaffolding, microtubules act as an internal rail network that can rapidly transport material about the cell. They do this by growing at one end and disintegrating at the other. So, bizarrely, it is the track rather than the train that provides the motive power. Newly made proteins enclosed in bags or vesicles simply hop on a convenient microtubule and are instantly speeded off to a faraway destination within the cell. The cellular rail network enables a eukaryote to overcome one of the biggest obstacles preventing a prokaryote becoming big, getting stuff around the cell. A eukaryote, rather than having to wait for proteins to diffuse slowly through the cytoplasm, speeds them around on its rapid transit network. But eukaryotes, despite being an enormous advance over prokaryotes, also have their limits. Orchestrating organelles is a complex activity. If a cell contained more than a few thousand of them, such orchestration would be beyond the capability of a nucleus. Eukaryotes, like prokaryotes, are a biological dead end. The way to increasing complexity lies in another direction, in cooperation on an unprecedented scale. Multicellular organisms. From the moment they arose, eukaryotes almost certainly cooperated with each other in increasingly sophisticated ways. But about 800 million years ago, they crossed a critical threshold. Nature had put together colonies of symbiotic prokaryotes to make eukaryotes. Now it repeated the trick. It put together colonies of symbiotic eukaryotes to make multicellular organisms. The fact that life on Earth spent about 3 billion years at the single-cell stage before it took the step to the multicellular stage is probably telling us that the step is a difficult one. This has implications for the prospects of finding extraterrestrial life. Despite 50 years of searching, astronomers have seen no sign of intelligence elsewhere in our galaxy. One possibility is that life is common in the Milky Way, but only in the form of single-celled microorganisms. Humans, as well as animals, plants and fungi, are all multicellular organisms. Each of us is a colony of about 100 million cells. They come in about 230 different types, ranging from brain cells and blood cells to muscle cells and sex cells, and all are enclosed in a bag made of skin cells, no less a container than the membrane of a single cell. Each cell has its own copy of the same DNA, apart from blood cells in their mature form, which are so utilitarian they lack even a nucleus. But whether a cell becomes a kidney cell, or a pancreatic cell, or a skin cell, depends on the particular section of the DNA that is read or expressed. This, in turn, depends on regulatory genes, themselves stretches of DNA, which can turn off and turn on the reading of DNA, depending on things such as the concentration of a particular chemical in the locality. Each of the 100 million cells that makes up a human being is a micro-world as complex as a major city, buzzing with the ceaseless activity of billions of nanomachines. It has storehouses, workshops, administrative centres, and streets heaving with traffic. "Power plants generate the cell's energy," says American journalist Peter Gwynn. "Factories produce proteins, vital units of chemical commerce. Complex transportation systems guide specific chemicals from point to point within the cell and beyond. Sentries at the barricades control the export and import markets and monitor the outside world for signs of danger. Disciplined biological armies stand ready to grapple with invaders. A centralized genetic government maintains order." And all of this is going on every moment of every day of our lives, while we remain utterly oblivious to it. In the words of biologist and writer Adam Rutherford, "Each movement, every heartbeat, thought, and emotion you've ever had, every feeling of love or hatred, boredom, excitement, pain, frustration or joy, every time you've ever been drunk and then hung over, every bruise, sneeze, itch or snotty nose, every single thing you've ever heard, seen, smelt or tasted, is your cells communicating with each other and the rest of the universe." We all start our lives as a single cell, when a sperm, the smallest cell in the body, fuses with an ovum, the biggest cell in the body, and one actually visible to the naked eye. Every human, in fact, spends about half an hour as a single cell before it splits into two. This is a phenomenal process in itself. In a mere 30 minutes, not only must a cell make a copy of its DNA, a process that for speed occurs simultaneously at multiple sites on the DNA, but it must construct something like 10 billion complex proteins. This is more than 100,000 a second. Within 60 minutes, the two cells split into four, then later eight, and so on. After several divisions, chemical differences across the developing embryo cause the cells to differentiate. It is a process that culminates in cells knowing that they have to be kidney cells, or brain cells, or skin cells. Over years, a single cell becomes a galaxy of cells, or rather, a thousand galaxies of cells. Hardly any of the cells in your body, apart from brain cells, are permanent. The cells lining the wall of the stomach are bathed in hydrochloric acid, strong enough to dissolve a razor blade, so must be remade constantly. You get a new stomach lining every 3 or 4 days. Blood cells last longer, but even they self-destruct after about 4 months. It is fair to say that you are pretty much a new person every 7 years, something that maybe explains the 7-year itch. You look at your partner and suddenly think, "That's not the person I got together with." The cells of your body die in such prodigious numbers that simply to replace them, you must build about 300 billion new cells every day. That is more cells than there are stars in our galaxy. No wonder it can be tiring doing nothing. Aliens. There may be an astronomical number of cells in your body, but they are not able to carry out all the functions necessary for your survival. Not without assistance from legions of alien cells, such as prokaryotes, fungi, and single-celled animals called protozoans. In your stomach, for instance, hundreds of species of bacteria work constantly to extract nutrients from your food. If some of these good bacteria are inadvertently killed by antibiotics, the result can be an affliction such as diarrhea. The alien bacteria protect you from illness by filling niches in your body that otherwise might be filled by disease-causing pathogens. The Human Microbiome Project, a 5-year study funded by the US government, presented its findings in 2012. It found that the nasal passages of about 29% of people contain Staphylococcus aureus, better known as the MRSA superbug. Since such people suffer no ill effects, the implication is that in healthy people, the bugs act as good bacteria, keeping harmful pathogens at bay. Remarkably, the Human Microbiome Project found that there are more than 10,000 species of alien cells in your body, 40 times the number of cell types that actually belong to you. You are only 2.5% human. In fact, about 5 million bacteria call every square centimetre of your skin home. The most densely populated regions are your ears, the back of your neck, the sides of your nose, and your belly button. What all these alien bacteria are doing is a mystery. The Human Microbiome Project found that 77% of the species in your nose, for instance, have completely unknown functions. The sheer number of alien bacteria in your body might actually underrate their importance. The Human Microbiome Project found that microorganisms that inhabit your body have a total of at least 8 million genes, each of which codes for a protein with a specific purpose. By contrast, the human genome contains a mere 23,000 genes. Consequently, there are about 400 times as many microbial genes exerting their effect on your body as human genes. In a sense, you are not even as much as 2.5% human. You are merely 0.25% human. Since the alien cells in your body are largely prokaryotes, which are much smaller than eukaryotes, they add up to a few kilograms, or a mere 1 to 3% of your mass. They are not encoded by your DNA, but infected you after birth via your mother's milk or directly from the environment. They were pretty much all in place by the time you were 3 years old. It is fair to say that we are born 100% human, but die 97.5% alien. The biological event horizon. Every cell is born from another cell, omnis cellula e cellula, as François Vincent Raspail first recognized in 1825. Consequently, every cell in our body, every cell on the earth, can trace its ancestry in an unbroken line back to the very first cell, which appeared about 4 billion years ago. The first cell is generally referred to as the last universal common ancestor, or LUCA. Nobody knows how exactly it came about. Undoubtedly, there was a vast amount of experimentation, a huge amount of pre-evolution, before nature hit on the design. Mistakes or mutations in genes accumulate at a steady rate over time. So if one species has twice as many mutations of a particular gene as a second species, we can say it split from a common ancestor twice as far back. This is how the tree of life, first envisaged by Charles Darwin, is constructed. However, bacteria have an inconvenient habit of swapping DNA, as well as passing DNA to their descendants. This means that in the vicinity of Lucca, the tree of life is less a tree and more like an impenetrable thicket. In physics, scientists talk of the event horizon, of a black hole, the point of no return for infalling matter. It cloaks the black hole so that nothing can be seen of its interior. Similarly, biologists talk of the biological event horizon beyond which nothing can be known. There, unfortunately, lies Lucca. Since the time of Lucca, the Earth, despite dabbling in multicellularity, has been a bacterial world. There are believed to be something like 10,000 billion, billion, billion bacteria on our planet. That is a billion times more bacteria than there are stars in the observable universe. But this might not give a true picture of terrestrial biology. Consider viruses. "We live in a dancing matrix of viruses," wrote Lewis Thomas. "They dart, rather like bees, from organism to organism, from plant to insect to mammal to me and back again, and into the sea, tugging along pieces of this genome, strings of genes from that, translating graphs of DNA, passing around heredity as though at a great party. Incapable of reproducing without hijacking the machinery of cells, viruses are generally not considered to be precursors of cellular life. But who knows? Chapter 2. The Rocket-Fueled Baby. Respiration. All our energy is a beam of sunlight set free from its captive state in food. Nick Lane, Life Ascending. We make our living by catching electrons at the moment of their excitement by solar photons, swiping the energy released at the instant of each jump, and storing it up in intricate loops for ourselves. Lewis Thomas, The Lives of a Cell. A rocket rises on a column of white smoke and orange flame. A baby kicks out in a moment of joy. These two things may appear to have nothing in common, but appearances are deceptive. Both are energized by essentially the same chemical reaction. Both are powered by rocket fuel. A moment's thought shows why this is not surprising. Boosting a heavy rocket into space requires the most powerful fuel, the one that, pound for pound, packs the biggest oomph. Life on Earth has been engaged for 3.8 billion years in trial and error experimentation. It would be odd if, in its efforts to power living organisms, it too had not stumbled on the most potent available energy source. That energy source is the chemical reaction between hydrogen and oxygen. In the case of all animals, it is hydrogen extracted from food and oxygen extracted from the air. In the case of a rocket, it is liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. So how does the reaction between hydrogen and oxygen work? And where exactly does the tremendous energy come from? That requires a little background knowledge. All atoms, including those of hydrogen and oxygen, consist of a tiny nucleus and even tinier electrons. The electrons orbit the nucleus, snared by its powerful electric force in much the same way that planets, influenced by the force of gravity, orbit the sun. There are many different ways the electrons can orbit in a given atom, but in general they are happiest being as close to the nucleus as possible to minimize their energy. This is a general principle of physics. For instance, a ball high on a hillside is said to have high gravitational energy. Given the slightest opportunity, it will try to minimize its energy, that is, roll down to the bottom of the hill, where it has low gravitational energy. Similarly, the electrons in an atom, as surely as balls rolling downhill, will try to minimize their energy. When two atoms come together, there may be new ways for their combined electrons to arrange themselves. If there is a configuration with a lower total energy than in two separate atoms, then, as inevitably as a ball rolling downhill, the atoms will combine to form a molecule. This is all chemistry is, the rearrangement of electrons. Since the energy of the molecule is less than the energy of the separate atoms that came together to make it, there is energy left over. It is a cornerstone of physics that energy can be neither created nor destroyed, only transformed from one form to another, for instance, from electrical energy into light energy. Consequently, the surplus energy becomes available to do things. In a rocket, for instance, the reaction between a hydrogen atom and an oxygen atom, actually two hydrogen atoms react with each oxygen atom to make H2O, water, liberates a large amount of energy. This heats the water and expels the white vapor at great speed from the back of the rocket. Action and reaction being equal and opposite, the high-speed exhaust propels the rocket forward. The liberation of so much energy by the reaction between hydrogen and oxygen is the reason it can lift a rocket to the edge of space. It is the reason why a marathon runner can go 26 miles, 385 yards on a bowl of pasta. It is the reason why the reaction is exploited by every last animal on Earth. Actually, the reaction between hydrogen and oxygen is not the only one that liberates energy. Before oxygen was present in substantial quantities in the Earth's atmosphere, organisms gleaned their energy from much less efficient processes such as fermentation. Yeast cells make alcohol via fermentation. The muscles of sprinters, when they run short of oxygen, make lactic acid via fermentation. In the fermentation process, only about 1% of the surplus energy is made available to do work. This can be compared with a whopping 40% in the case of the reaction of hydrogen with oxygen. These two numbers tell us something interesting and profound about the biological world. In order to have carnivores, it is necessary to have at least three layers in the food chain: plants, animals that eat plants, and animals that eat animals that eat plants. But if only 1% of the energy of plants is available to the animals that feed on them, then only 1% of 1%, that is, a mere 0.01%, is available to animals that feed on those animals, and so on. So until oxygen became available in more or less modern quantities about 580 million years ago, there could be no carnivores. Actually, bacteria learned the oxygen trick more than 2 billion years ago, but there were only tiny amounts of O2 available at the time. In fact, it is estimated that the oxygen trick boosted the amount of biomass on Earth by an astonishing factor of about 1,000. Instead of two tiers, or trophic levels in the food chain, suddenly it was possible to have five or six. The bewildering complexity of life on Earth today owes everything to the exploitation of oxygen. Battery-powered biology. But how exactly does the oxygen trick work? In a rocket, hydrogen and oxygen combine to make water, with the explosive release of a large amount of heat energy. Clearly, living organisms do not make use of such a violent process. They would be blown apart. Instead, they liberate the energy step by step in a far less destructive and subtle way. What actually happens when hydrogen and oxygen react together in a rocket is what happens in all chemical reactions. The electrons play a game of musical chairs. Specifically, an oxygen atom grabs electrons from two hydrogen atoms. In the process, the oxygen and hydrogen atoms fuse into a molecule of water. However, say the hydrogen atoms supply electrons to an oxygen atom, but the hydrogen atoms and oxygen atom never actually meet. This is the non-explosive twist on the oxygen-hydrogen reaction that is exploited by biology. The first requirement is to obtain hydrogen. The gas does not exist in its free state on Earth. Being the lightest of all gases, if created in any quantity, it would float off into space. Inside a cell, however, an amazingly subtle and energy-efficient process called the Krebs cycle strips hydrogen atoms from food, that is, from either molecules of sugar, glucose, C6H12O6, or fat. Two hydrogen atoms then donate their electrons to an oxygen atom. Only this does not happen directly, as in a rocket. Between the hydrogen atoms and the oxygen atom stretches a long wire made of protein complexes, and the donated electrons, bursting with excess energy, hop from one location to location down the wire. Focus on a single electron. As it hops down the wire, as inevitably as a ball rolling downhill, it drives hydrogen nuclei, or protons, through channels or pores in the cell membrane. Since protons carry an electric charge, the opposite of electrons, this charges up one side of the membrane with respect to the other. Something like this happens in a battery. It creates an electric force field between the battery's terminals, and actually this hints at what the super energetic electron does as it thunders down the protein wire to an oxygen atom. It turns the cell membrane into a charged up battery. The resulting electric force field across the membrane is stupendously powerful. It is comparable, in fact, to the electric field that, in a thunderstorm, breaks down the atoms in the air and unleashes a multi-million volt bolt of lightning. You might imagine that the cells in your body should crackle with lightning. However, the tremendous electric force field extends over only the tiny thickness of a cell membrane, about 0.005 millimetre. And other molecules intervene to stop this force field having its way. Interestingly, however, in programmed cell death or apoptosis, this protective mechanism is turned off, and cells are, in effect, killed off by their own internal lightning bolts. The powerful electric force field of the membrane battery drives a chemical reaction that creates adenosine triphosphate, or ATP. Such molecules are stores of energy. Think of them as portable batteries. So as the electron bounces down the protein wire, losing energy all the while, it leaves in its wake a large number of energy-packed ATP molecules. Released into the wild, these have the ability to power cellular processes wherever and whenever necessary. In the final analysis, you are battery-powered. There are about 1 billion ATP molecules in your body, and all of these are used and recycled every 1 to 2 minutes. Toys may require a handful of batteries that become flat in a few hours. Contrast this with your body, which uses up 10 million power packs every second. Thank goodness that for human beings, batteries are included. Finally, the electron arrives at the end of the protein wire, exhausted of its energy. There it combines with the waiting oxygen atom. When a second electron from another hydrogen atom joins it, the oxygen atom achieves the highly desirable state of a filled outer shell of electrons. But this is not quite the end of the story. If the oxygen atom passes the electrons to a carbon atom, left behind when hydrogen was stripped from the food in the Krebs cycle, the result is a very stable molecule of carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide, along with water vapor, is what oxygen-breathing animals exhale as waste. Breathing. So much for the chemistry of respiration. What about its physiology? Well, we breathe in air, of which about 20% is oxygen. Only about a quarter of this actually gets used, so exhaled air still contains about 15% oxygen. This is why it is possible to revive an unconscious person with exhaled breath via mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Our breath is drawn deep down into our lungs, the inner surfaces of which have a structure on the smallest scale rather like a branching tree. The branches, known as alveoli, run alongside fine blood vessels, and oxygen molecules pass from them to red blood cells. The tree-like structure of the alveoli maximizes the area over which this oxygen transfer can occur, maximizing the amount of oxygen that can enter the bloodstream. Remarkably, the surface area of a human lung is similar to that of a tennis court. When an oxygen molecule is transferred to a blood cell, it is picked up by a giant protein called hemoglobin. It is then ferried to a cell where the oxygen is combined with hydrogen stripped from food to liberate energy for the cell. Crucially, hemoglobin changes its behavior depending on the acidity of its surroundings. The acidity at its cellular destination changes the protein in a subtle way so that it repels rather than attracts its passenger. The protein therefore drops off its precious oxygen molecule. But the change in the hemoglobin means that it now attracts a molecule of carbon dioxide. As soon as one latches on, it is promptly ferried back to the lungs, where it passes from blood vessels to alveoli and is exhaled. The oxygen we breathe, and that powers all the biological processes in our bodies, is essential to keep us alive. Whereas we can survive without food for a month and without water for a week, we can survive without air supply cut off for only about 3 minutes. Every instant of our lives, we are a mere 3 minutes from death. This fact becomes shockingly apparent to a heart attack victim whose heart stutters to a halt and stops pumping oxygen around the arteries and blood vessels of his or her body. Photosynthesis. But where does the oxygen we breathe come from? The answer, of course, is plants. Rather than breathing in oxygen and breathing out carbon dioxide, they take in carbon dioxide and pump out oxygen. Pretty much all the energy used by life on Earth is therefore ultimately the energy of sunlight, which plants capture directly from the sun. The trick is mind-bogglingly clever. Otherwise, we would long ago have found a way of mimicking it and powering human civilization directly from sunlight. The energy of a particle of light, a photon, is transferred to an electron in a giant protein called chlorophyll. This is the molecule responsible for the green pigment of plants, although life also uses a second non-green version. Bursting with energy, the electron can then energize chemical processes. Photosynthesis is a bewilderingly complex process, but in essence it achieves the exact opposite of respiration. Whereas respiration splits hydrogen from foods such as sugars and passes its electron to oxygen, ejecting as waste carbon dioxide, photosynthesis splits hydrogen from water and uses it with carbon from carbon dioxide to build sugars, ejecting as waste the leftover oxygen. Pause for a moment to think what an amazing trick this is. Using nothing more than water, carbon dioxide from the air and sunlight, plants are able to synthesize energy-rich food. The sugars made by plants are, in essence, captured sunlight. And whenever we eat plants, we in effect unleash the energy of this captured sunlight. But the miracle does not end there. Some plants, such as trees, when they die, can become buried and transformed by heat and pressure deep down in the ground into fossil fuels such as coal. When we burn coal, we unleash yesterday's sunlight. Ultimately, everything on Earth is powered by a beam of captured sunlight. Photosynthesis is actually quite inefficient. The percentage of incoming light energy that is converted into sugar in most plants is only about 1%. The race is on, therefore, not only to create artificial photosynthesis, but to make it significantly better than in nature, converting, say, 20% of incident sunlight into hydrogen. Hydrogen, when combined with oxygen, think rocket fuel, think respiration, liberates large amounts of energy. It could, therefore, be used in fuel cells to power all manner of machines, from cars to computers. There are three main steps in the creation of artificial photosynthesis. First, light must be captured and its energy transferred to an electron, boosting its energy. Next, the electron must be freed from its parent atom. Finally, the super-energetic electron must be used to smash apart water to liberate the all-important hydrogen. Artificial photosynthesis, able to make hydrogen fuel from sunlight, would wean the human race from its dependence on fast-dwindling reserves of fossil fuels such as oil. It would be a game-changing technology. It could transform the world. Chapter 3. Walking Backwards to the Future. Evolution. Evolution is a tinkerer. François Jacob, Evolution and Tinkering.
Pigs, look us straight in the eye and see an equal.
Winston Churchill. Question. What do aeroplanes and television sets and lampposts have in common with frogs and whales and people? Answer. All are highly improbable configurations of matter, and all do what they do extremely well. The technological things in the first group were designed by human beings. An obvious conclusion to draw from the similarity between the two groups would therefore be that the living things in the second group were also designed. The obvious conclusion, however, is wrong. The illusion of design in nature is so strong that it was not recognized as an illusion until the 19th century. In Europe at the time, there was a pretty much universal belief that living things had been created and put on Earth in their present forms by a supreme being. The scientists of the day were mostly religious, and the very last thing they wanted to do was question such an idea and bring down on themselves the wrath of the Church. However, scientists have no choice but to go with the evidence, and the evidence was overwhelming that the bewildering diversity of life on Earth, everything from bacteria to blue whales, fungi to flying foxes, gorillas to giant sequoias, is the consequence of a purely natural mechanism. An important clue came from fossils. These appeared to be the relics of ancient creatures buried by sediments settling to the bottom of lakes and seas and somehow, nobody knew exactly, turned to stone. Fossils reveal that the creatures that inhabit the Earth today are not the same as the ones that once inhabited the planet. Some ancient creatures, such as the dinosaurs, have disappeared entirely, whereas other vanished creatures appear related to creatures today. The simplest, most primitive creatures appear fossilized in the oldest sediments. As the rock layers became progressively younger, the fossils became ever more complex and sophisticated. The idea dawned on scientists that the fossil record was a time sequence of life on Earth. It was telling us that over vast tracts of time, species of creatures gradually changed their appearance, morphing from one into another and eventually becoming the species we see around us today. Life was not created on day one by a creator, remaining frozen and static forever after. Instead, it has evolved, gradually, from simpler ancestral forms. Such evolution explains the striking similarities between creatures living today, such as humans and chimpanzees. If all life on Earth descended from a common ancestor in the distant past, it is obvious that all creatures today are related. But what drives evolution? What causes species to change over the generations? And how have all creatures ended up doing what they do so incredibly well that they give every appearance of being designed? The man who found the answer was Charles Darwin. Darwin embarked on HMS Beagle in 1831. During his 5 years as the ship's naturalist, he made some tantalizing observations of the biological world. On the Galapagos Archipelago, 1,000 kilometers off the west coast of South America, the finches on different islands had different shaped beaks. In all cases, the beaks were perfectly shaped for exploiting the nuts available locally. short, stubby beaks for cracking open big nuts, slender beaks for less formidable seeds. An explanation began to form in Darwin's mind when he also noticed that the birds and animals on the Galapagos were but slight variants of those common on the mainland of South America. The Galapagos, it seemed, had been colonized by creatures from the nearby continent. Some birds and animals from South America that could easily have made a living on the Galapagos were conspicuous by their absence. Only a small subset had made it across the ocean barrier on winds or mats of floating vegetation. It had been these hardy creatures that had radiated to fill all the empty niches, a single type of finch spreading to all islands and evolving beaks best suited to exploit the seeds found locally. Darwin was now in possession of new and important clues about evolution, but he did not know what was driving the changes in species, what was pushing each to an apparent perfect fit with its environment. Back in England in 1836, and still only 27, he sat down at his desk, laid out the facts he had collected before him, and began to think. Darwin was aware of one common way that creatures changed their forms over the generations, by deliberate breeding. Plants and domestic animals inherit physical traits from their parents, and these can be enhanced. To create a flock of sheep with the thickest possible woolly coats, for instance, breeders select sheep with the thick coats, mate them together, and repeat the process generation after generation. But whereas humans select for traits they desire in an animal or plant, nature appears to select for traits that maximize an organism's chance of survival in its environment. Such natural selection might not be as fast as the artificial selection of human breeders, but it is just as effective. After Darwin had spent 18 months of intense concentration on the problem, a light went on in his mind. He suddenly saw the elusive mechanism of natural selection, and it was breathtakingly simple. One of the striking things about the natural world is how profligate organisms are. Invariably, animals give birth to large litters of young. Plants produce vast quantities of seeds, but there is simply not enough food in the world to support so many young. Inevitably, therefore, most creatures starve to death. Crucially, Darwin realized, the only ones who survive to reproduce are those with traits that best enable them to make a living in their environment. And these traits are inherited by the next generation. So, as time goes by, the prevalence of beneficial traits in a population increases at the expense of traits that do not confer survivability. This was it, the missing piece of the jigsaw. Evolution by natural selection. How extremely stupid not to have thought of that, said Darwin's friend and champion, Thomas Huxley. But of course Darwin had to see past the dizzying complexity of the natural world to the mechanism ticking at its heart and quietly generating its complexity. And that was no mean feat. Richard Dawkins has called evolution by natural selection the greatest idea in the history of science, and it certainly has phenomenal explanatory power. Modern biology is literally the story of evolution by natural selection.
Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution, wrote Theodosius Dobzhansky in 1937.
According to his biographers, Darwin made no effort to publicize his idea, realizing full well that it flew in the face of the Church's teaching that God created all living creatures in their final form. Only in 1858, after 20 years of sitting on his explosive idea, was he galvanized into action. A letter arrived from a man called Alfred Russel Wallace, who, while observing nature in Indonesia and Malaysia, had hit on the exact same unifying idea of evolution by natural selection. Stunned, Darwin locked himself in his study and began writing furiously. Darwin's epochal work, published in 1859, is universally known as The Origin of Species, though it says essentially nothing about the ultimate origin of life, which to this day remains a deep mystery. More apposite is the book's full, though considerably more long-winded, title, On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or the Preservation of Favoured Races in the Struggle for Life. According to Darwin, all life on Earth today has evolved over eons of time from a common ancestral organism by the process of natural selection. The idea conflicted not only with the biblical account of creation as a one-off event, but with the Church's claims that humans were uniquely forged in the image of God. According to Darwin, humans were neither at the pinnacle of creation nor special in any other way. They were just another animal. Just as in the 16th century the Polish astronomer Nicolaus Copernicus showed that the Earth was not at the centre of things and occupied no special place in the cosmos, Darwin showed that humans were not at the centre of things and occupied no special place in the living world. Darwin was courageous to present a theory that flew in the face of entrenched religious orthodoxy, but he was also very honest about the theory's shortcomings, freely admitting it was incomplete. He asked people instead to judge the idea on its broad claims, which he was sure were correct, and not on the fine details, which he did not possess, but which he was certain future generations of biologists would fill in. Two things stood out as glaring omissions. The first was the mechanism of variation. People clearly inherit traits from both their mother and their father. It is possible to see a mother's red hair in a child's or a father's square jaw. But what causes the appearance of new traits from which natural selection, selects? The second thing missing from Darwin